rights.
Dolores Huerta, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Renowned civil rights activist, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, and president of the Dolores Huerta Foundation. We spoke to her at her home in Bakersfield, California. She is 95 years old. Happy birthday to Safi Nazal. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Scarloween with Space Monkey Mafia at the Turf Club Friday, October 31st. Like a Frankenstein's monster of music, Space Monkey Mafia stitches together punk, metal, swing, and rock, and then brings it to life with a healthy jolt of ska. They're touring with their latest release, Death of the Party. Opening the show are Alien Book Club, The Prize Fighters, The Vaughn Tramps, and Marlos Passos. More information about Scarloween with Space Monkey Mafia at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and around the world at kfai.org, where community grows.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mini Culture Presents. My name is Michael Whetstone. Today on the program, we are going to present the final episode of the Mini Culture Podcast from Season 9. I am delighted to play it for you on the airwaves, but I want you to know that you can also find this in your podcast feed. If you subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast, there are now 9 great seasons for you to enjoy. You can find it wherever you enjoy listening to your podcast. And if you'd like to help keep these sort of stories on your radio dial, consider making a pledge today to Mini Culture's radio home. KFAI relies on your financial support. This is real community, truly people-powered public radio. Thank you. And now, here is the final episode of the Mini Culture Podcast, Season 9, about the many Minnesotans who played a role in helping via the Underground Railroad. It is called Seeking Freedom in Minnesota by producer Michelle Brook.
Welcome to Mini Culture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. When you think about the Underground Railroad, you might not think about Minnesota, but you should, because many Minnesotans provided safe harbor, housing, and transportation for African American freedom seekers during the 19th century. In the final episode of this season, producer Michelle Brook tells the story of African American barbers, cooks, and steamboat stewards who conducted the Underground Railroad right here in St. Paul.
The Underground Railroad into St. Paul was not a road at all. It was a river. William Taylor was often waiting at the wharf when steamboats docked in St. Paul. As several hundred passengers disembarked, he watched for people who were running to freedom. They might be traveling alone, scanning the crowd for a friendly face. Or they might be walking with Eugene Berry, a black steamboat steward who would introduce them to Taylor. A short walk from the river, there were lots of places to hide. The church belfry, the ice cream shop, the hayloft of a stagecoach business, and the home of William and Adeline Taylor. According to their nephew, the Taylors had support from more than 50 people, the community of African Americans who lived in St. Paul.
Get on board, little children. Get on board, little children. Get on board, little children. There's room for many or more.
If you'd lived in St. Paul during the 1850s, you probably would have known William Taylor, and you probably would have liked him. Writers described him as large, jolly, and kind. His barbershop stood on the street we know today as Kellogg Boulevard. Ads in the paper said his shaving saloon was built up to the increasing style and elegance of the growing metropolis.
The main barbershop was William Taylor's place.
This is William Green, an author and former professor of history at Augsburg University. He explained that barbers at this time could earn a good living serving white clientele.
The barbershop was a place where an individual could pay for a shave, which meant a certain class of person. So this is where the leaders met.
Census records list Taylor as either black or mulatto, indicating mixed ancestry. He was 29 years old in 1850. He listed his birthplace as Kentucky.
You know, it occurred to me that I don't even know if this is his real name. William Taylor is a hard name necessarily to document. There are a lot of white guys named William Taylor. And that's one reason why you select that name for yourself if you want to disappear, so to speak.
But Taylor's name was very well known in St. Paul. He played the fiddle and formed a band with other barbers. This is one of the songs he played, called The Girl I Left Behind Me. John Heine is a musician who scoured newspapers and books to learn more about Taylor and his music.
One place where I found particular music mention. Taylor's band discourse sweet music while the knives and forks kept time.
Taylor's band performed at hundreds of dances. During the winter, this was St. Paul's entertainment. There would be a feast at midnight and dancing until dawn. You can hear the kind of music they played at the Minneapolis Eagles Club Monday Night Square Dance. Writers at the time said Taylor had a clear, strong voice a general would envy. Everyone was happy when he did the calling.
Calling the figures is directing the dance.
Forward and back. Two hands swing.
And the caller would call off something like,
and do-si-do.
Join hands and circle to the left.
And down you go.
Michaela Day works as project manager in the community archives at Eastside Freedom Library in St. Paul.
Playing the fiddle in all of these elite white society parties, cotillions, and so forth, the same way that information is passed through barbershops, I'm sure that Taylor was able to get a lead on the specific sheriffs that were known as being vicious, quote-unquote, slave catchers here in Minnesota. So I'm sure that provided him with inside information.
Bow to your partners, one and all, and thank the band. That's it, that's all.
Taylor lived a popular public life.
How about this band, everybody?
But not everyone knew his secret.
He was basically a confidant, in effect, a person who the movers and shakers, some of whom had no investment in protecting slaves, where they felt comfortable. So this is a man who's living two or three different worlds, in effect.
Taylor's world was complicated. Minnesota was supposed to be free territory, but the state did tolerate slavery.
The people who are running the city and the people who are running the state are actually people who have money tied up with enslavers.
This is St. Cloud State professor and author Christopher P. Lehman.
Minnesotans, especially those involved in the tourism industry, did not mind Southerners bringing enslaved people with them.
In addition, the National Fugitive Slave Law that passed in 1850 required that anyone who escaped be returned to their enslavers in the South.
If you are an officer of the law in the North, and the Fugitive Slave Act is part of the law, you have to enforce that law too. Especially if the enslavers come looking for their enslaved people. If the northern locals did not do that, they could be held criminally responsible.
Military officials at Fort Snelling also enslaved people, including Dred and Harriet Scott. Dred himself tried to escape as a young man in St. Louis when he was about to be sold to an army surgeon he despised. For several days, he dodged between the homes of fellow enslaved people. He was discovered at a resort beyond the city limits, and the doctor eventually brought him to Fort Snelling. Years later, the Scots sued for their freedom because the fort was supposed to be free territory. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled against them, stating that enslaved people were not U.S. citizens and should not expect federal protection.
starting in March of 1857, with the Dred Scott decision, slavery was actually legal in Minnesota until Minnesota became a state, because the decision legalized slavery in all the territories.
Minnesota joined the Union as a free state in 1858, so slavery was legal here for a full year. One black resident of St. Paul wrote a furious letter of protest to the newspaper. He wrote that ever since he saw the light of day, he'd been oppressed by his country, yet he loved her still. Signed, Moses Dixon, Alien American. We know now that Dixon was a supporter of the Underground Railway. The stories we currently have about the Underground Railroad in St. Paul are thanks to Taylor's nephew, Joseph Farr. Joseph worked on steamboats as a cabin boy, and he became accustomed to seeing enslaved people on the boat, trying to reach safety. Later, as a young man, he worked in Taylor's barber shop and helped his uncle with the rescue efforts. Joseph wished he had saved memoirs. He forgot names and dates. But he started talking to newspaper reporters in his early 60s, sitting in his parlor, surrounded by family. His accounts are preserved in the May 5, 1895 St. Paul Pioneer Press and the April 16, 1905 St. Paul Globe. Several details vary between the newspapers, but here's the story Joseph seemed to remember best from the summer of 1852. Underground Railroad agent Eugene Berry walked off a steamboat and introduced a young, handsome person. Their skin was light enough to pass for white, and they wore an expensive suit. As they collapsed into tears, Joseph learned this was a young woman in disguise, running from an enslaver who'd brought her north to Galena. In Galena, she was thrilled to meet an agent named Johnson, who came up with all kinds of schemes to get people away from enslavers. Johnson disguised people as well as he could, and then Berry would help them hide in the steamboat freight. Here's William Green.
Some captains seemed to be sympathetic to helping the fugitive, or may have done it because they get paid. You know, we'll pay you X number if you just kind of look the other way as we get this guy into the cargo.
It was easy enough to get out of Galena on steamboats like the Dr. Franklin and the Nominee. The trouble was finding a place of safety after that. The girl stayed with Adeline Taylor that night. Joseph figured that someone paid a couple $1,000s for her down south, and they would come looking for her. Sure enough, the next day, a tall, mean-looking Southerner with a wide-brimmed hat and dark clothes stepped into Taylor's barbershop. The Southerner heard that Taylor knew all about the fugitives that came to St. Paul. Find her, and the Southerner would give a $30 reward. That's more than $1,000 today. Taylor told the Southerner he never took money, but he often helps people recover their property. He offered a shave and kept the Southerner talking, while barber James Highwarden slipped out the back. Here's local historian Karen Sieber.
If they could get that slaveholder into the barber chair, they knew where he was for 45 minutes, and it gave them this other window of time in which they could communicate and be able to help someone else escape in that short window of time.
James got a horse and buggy and brought the girl to an old French couple's farm near Stillwater. When officers came close, the farmers helped her hide in the woods, 4 miles from the house, for a couple of weeks. These were the days of Deputy Sheriff Brackett. Writers said he was a relentless foe of the Underground Railroad and moved down upon his victims like a tornado. He camped on their trail and paid bribes for information. Here's William Green.
Money's rare. Most people are poor. So all that a slave catcher needed to do was to crease the palm of somebody. You know, relationships are key here.
And I won't take nothing from my journey now.
God's gonna travel the water than we need.
When the search was over, the girl traveled with agents back to St. Paul, switched her disguise, and she doubled back to Galena on a steamboat. From there, she planned to travel to Chicago. A few months later, Taylor received a letter from Canada. It was from the girl. She was safe. Joseph Farr's account highlights what historians are beginning to understand about the Underground Railroad.
It's been romanticized a lot. Even the term has been confusing for some people.
This is Penn Bogart, a historian based in Kentucky.
When anyone uses the term Underground Railroad, you think of a well-organized, kind of a linear trek from start to finish, which in some cases it was, but probably in most cases it wasn't. And it tends to obscure the challenges and struggles that individuals and whole families had to face that did not get any particular amount of aid. You know, they would, you know, from place to place, knowing where they were going, the right direction, but not knowing who could help them.
Joseph Farr remembered one man who escaped from St. Louis on a steamboat. He heard there were friendly people in St. Paul who could help him get to Canada. Taylor spotted him at the riverfront and brought him to the bell tower of First Presbyterian Church. This was a dependable hiding place that was never discovered. A sexton at the church brought people food and took them outside at night to stretch and walk in the dark part of the city. After a week went by, the man's new friends gave him money and sent him on a boat to continue his journey. But he only got as far as Prescott. Deputy Sheriff Brackett bribed a steward, learned he was on the boat, and arrested him.
The farther north you got, the better chance you had of not getting caught. It was a struggle until you actually got to freedom because people were coming after you, no matter where you went.
For some freedom seekers, Minnesota offered their first chance at escape. Wealthy Southerners avoided the summer heat by vacationing here, and they brought enslaved servants with them. Micah L. Anders is a professional genealogist and historian. She said enslavers were aware of the Underground Railroad as they traveled north.
But a lot of the Southerners knew. So, you know, they would usually say, okay, well, your kids are staying home with us. Or, you know, your husband or your wife is going to stay in the South, so you don't come back, something bad will happen to them.
Local Black residents watched for opportunities to privately offer people a path to freedom. David Edwards Talbert was among the most active and persevering agents on St. Paul's Underground Railroad. He worked as a cook at hotels like the International, where Southerners often stayed. Here's Karen Sieber.
The Underground Railroad was largely Black-led. It was a network built on opportunity and a network that was made to be malleable depending on the situations and the needs.
I think it's important to keep in mind that they're kind of on a tightrope in a sense. They don't want their barns burned. They don't want harassment. They don't want to lose their social standing. They want safety. So they're going to keep it quiet. No one's going to go around asking, are you a member of the Underground Railroad?
One young man, enslaved as a body servant, escaped from the International Hotel and made it to Taylor's place. They rushed him out into the country. They thought he would be safe with a caretaker of color at Point Prescott in Wisconsin. But the enslaver offered a huge reward for the man's capture. The caretaker turned him in. Joseph supposed the man was nearly flogged to death. Joseph said that after a while, Southern vacationers became afraid of the Underground Railroad. Agents of color had to work hard just to get close enough to speak to enslaved people. Joseph believed their work made an impact. He said, quote, "I can't tell how many slaves we got away, but we were so industrious that the slave owners gave up bringing their slaves with them when they came up here, long before the war." William Taylor died in his early 40s. Far from home in southern Minnesota. His death is not a simple story. Under signed treaties, the U.S. government was supposed to make annual payments to the Dakota in exchange for taking their land. It was common for civilians to tag along during these annuity payments as a fun excursion. Taylor often joined them to cut hair. But in 1862, the payment was late. The Dakota people were very hungry. When the Dakota asked one trader for food, promising to pay when the money came, the trader told them to eat grass. Here's William Green.
Taylor went out basically, you know, thinking that he could make, you know, additional money and establish more clientele and whatnot and just get out of the city, you know, get out of St. Paul. And he just, you know, went out there at a bad time. People just didn't expect the uprising, you know, the Dakota War.
According to survivors of the U.S. Dakota War, Taylor was inside a store when about 25 Dakota people attacked. He asked them, "What shall I do?" They told him to run. And as he ran toward the river, they fired. He died where he fell. Just a few days prior, Taylor had his photo taken in Dakota dress, and he gave it to Chief Little Crow. A writer documenting the war speculated that if Little Crow had been there, Taylor would not have been killed, because Taylor was such a likable guy. The St. Paul Daily Press said Taylor's untimely death was regretted by the whole community. Adeline Taylor worked as a laundress and continued to own their St. Paul home until the last decade of her life. She spent time with friends at Lake Harriet and visited her family in Washington, D.C. She died at age 78 at her niece Ellen Yancey's farm in Edina. Adeline is buried at Lakewood Cemetery in an unmarked grave. When Joseph Farr died at age 78, newspaper tributes said his barbershop dated back to the days when St. Paul was a small city, and he shaved all the governors of Minnesota, from Ramsey to Merriam. They called him a leading spirit in the early history of St. Paul.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot. I said, it's coming for to carry me home.
I couldn't find living descendants of the people who worked on the Underground Railroad, but Joseph Farr and Moses Dixon helped found the first Masonic Lodge in the state open to African Americans, and it's still running.
My name is Charles E. Terrell, Jr., and for these brothers to come together and start a lodge in 1866... is still in existence in 2025. It speaks volumes to me.
Charles is a member of Pioneer Lodge No. 1, founded by Underground Railroad agents. He's currently the grandmaster of all the Prince Hall lodges in Minnesota, plus two in North Dakota.
You have to realize, this was a year after the Civil War. At that time, during that era, for African Americans, you had only two places to go for relief. That was the church and a Prince Hall Lodge. That was it. A lot of lodges, I wouldn't say they formed in secret. During the slavery time, during the Underground Railroad time, it may have been a secret to the slave hunt catchers and the governments, but it wasn't a secret in the African-American community. You just had Masons who knew a person who knew a person who knew a person.
The way Charles tells it, it's easy to see the through line between the Underground Railroad, the early Masons, and the Lodge today.
And the goal of the lodges, then and as well as today, is charity work. You come together and help out whoever needs it at the time. You know, not everyone's blessed, but if you get a strong number who's blessed just a little, you'll be surprised how much that little bit helps out this person over here. History just continues to repeat itself in different ways, if you look back and pay attention. It's constantly repeating itself, you know. The same things are going on, you know, and you have to have a strong community to endure, regardless of what it is.
I'm not part of the African American community. I'm white, with the privilege to work in journalism and spend time digging into this history. I have a feeling that the music in this story conveys more than I can. Some scholars hear double meanings in the lyrics of old spirituals. I wish I knew more, and I'm not the only one. Historians are researching Underground Railroad connections all over the state, and they're working to raise awareness about the railway's place in Minnesota history. Elise Hill is a certified genealogist who grew up in St. Paul.
I just think it's an interesting history, and it should be told, and people should know about it. You know, I mean, I hate to say, I was born and raised in Minnesota. I didn't know any of this stuff.
In recent years, Elise Hill has successfully nominated two Minnesota sites to the National Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. That's a historic preservation program run by the National Park Service.
You know, just to acknowledge these people and the sacrifices and the hardships that they endured and all that to become free and, you know, and to live within the state.
Elise nominated the Pilgrim Baptist Church in St. Paul, which was founded by freedom seekers shortly after emancipation. The newest Network to Freedom site is the Minneapolis Pioneers and Soldiers Memorial Cemetery. It's the burial place for William C. Goodridge. He was granted freedom as a teenager and grew up to become a wealthy entrepreneur in Pennsylvania. He helped freedom seekers hide in his rail cars, and he installed a trap door under his kitchen carpet. He moved to Minneapolis to live with his daughter, Emily Gray. Emily herself was an abolitionist. She helped Eliza Winston win her freedom in court. The cemetery is also the burial place for freedom seekers like Hester Patterson from Mississippi. Hester was enslaved on a cotton plantation for 60 years and carried scars on her back. She escaped during the Civil War and connected with the 5th Minnesota Infantry. She was a terrific cook and worked as a laundress and owned two plots of land on Hennepin Island.
What's fascinating about somebody like Hester is frustrating how little we know, but also kind of amazing that we know as much as we do.
This is Sue Hunter Weir, chair of Friends of the Cemetery. She's ordering a new marker to set on Hester Patterson's unmarked grave this spring.
Who do we choose to remember? Who do we choose to forget? Keeping in mind that we're making choices about that all the time.
The group is working to identify every African American buried in the cemetery.
We have kind of a hearty cast of volunteers and fed them pizza, and we flipped through 22,000 cards. Yeah. It turned out to be bigger than we thought, but it's fascinating. Their stories are fascinating, and they knew each other, they cared for each other. That feels like a really important story.
I was so excited when I found out about that project because it's affirming.
This is Micah Anders.
It's really taking this sort of hypothetical idea that, yeah, there were some people here, and saying, no, there was a sizable population. And they were here, and, you know, all these vets came up here. Often they were enslaved until they fought in the Civil War, and the Civil War became their means for freedom. And then they decided to come to Minnesota after that.
Here's Karen Sieber.
People tend to think of Minnesota as having a minimal role in the Underground Railroad. There's not been a lot of research done upon it. And we don't think about the fact that there have been Black communities here since before statehood. Before Minnesota became a state, there have been communities embedded in the civil rights movement, that this has always been a place of change and pushing for change and pushing for equality.
According to the St. Paul Globe, the Underground Railroad station in St. Paul only helped a small number of people reach Canada. But the paper said many others found homes in the Twin Cities and surrounding states with the help of William and Adeline Taylor's network.
Well, I looked over Jordan, and what did I see? Coming for to carry me home. Well, it was a band of angels coming after me. Coming for to carry me home. Why don't
Here's William Green.
I think we got a lot of heroes in history who, despite their humanity and their flaws, did the right thing. That's what makes a hero. They don't become saint-like. They just become normal people who did the right thing at the right time. They're rare in that regard.
If you get to them before I do, coming for to carry me home, tell friends, I'm coming up there too. Coming for to carry me home. Why don't you swing?
He felt the need to come up here and not disappear. I mean, he could have come up here and built a shop and just, you know, have a quiet life. He could have done that. He continued to spirit black people up here.
Oh, it's coming for to carry me home. It's coming.
This is Michelle Brook for KFAI.
Oh, it's coming for to carry me home.
This episode was written and produced by Michelle Brook. Special thanks to Jim Cizevich, John S. Wright, Davu Underwood-Seru, G. Philip Schultz, Bilal Salim, Sarah Holger, Brian Grandison, Sharon Harper, Amanda Loop, Maritime Heritage Minnesota, Franz Neumeier, the Edina Historical Society, and the Minnesota Historical Society. Fiddler A.J. Srubis performed The Girl I Left Behind Me, Wade in the Water, and Moses, Don't Get Lost, used with permission from Global Jukebox Publishing, courtesy of the Lomex Archives. Joe Carter's performance of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot was recorded by the podcast on Being with Krista Tippett for the 2003 episode Joe Carter the Spirituals, used with permission from the On Being Project. Additional music provided by the Library of Congress, Blue Dot Sessions, and Vocal Essence. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sensulo. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Thanks for listening.
Thursdays from 10 to noon, only on KFAI.
You are tuned in to Mini Culture Presents. Earlier in the show, we heard the final episode of Season 9 of the Mini Culture Podcast, Episode 7, Seeking Freedom in Minnesota, from producer Michelle Brook. Be sure to subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast so you can enjoy all 9 seasons full of arts, culture, and history stories about our great state. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members like you and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You may have heard that our new old president is not much of a fan of the CPB, so if you are able to help out KFAI financially, please do. Now is the time. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Coming up for you now, I've got some more really cool mini culture stories. In these, we are going to visit what is known to some as the sacred birthplace of Minnesota, or even Minnesota's Garden of Eden. And then we're going to learn of the efforts to keep it from being paved over. Yes, just like a Joni Mitchell song. We'll also take a ride along with a home healthcare nurse and visit the Schubert Club Museum in St. Paul in stories from Jackie Maddox, Armé Rivard, Allison Young. But first, a story from our very own Lady J, a voice familiar to you, I am sure. Here's Julie with more.
This is Miniculture on KFAI. You may know Jackie Maddox as Lady J from Songs of the Soul here on KFAI. But outside of her broadcast career, Jackie is the mother of two sons, David and Christopher, who both have hemophilia B, a disorder that prevents the blood from clotting and can cause excessive bleeding and bruising. Twice a week, a home healthcare nurse comes to Christopher and David's homes to deliver doctor-prescribed care. When Jackie realized just how long this specific nurse had been administering home health care to patients around the Twin Cities, she was shocked. So Jackie started up a conversation with this 50-year veteran nurse.
Sally Knutson is a home health care nurse. I joined her on her way to visit a patient with hemophilia.
Hi there, sir. How are you today?
A little better than before.
I hear that shoulder's improving.
Yeah, much better. Okay, much better.
This particular patient is my son, Christopher. I got to know Sally throughout the COVID-19 crisis when she delivered blood products to Christopher and to my other son, David, who also has hemophilia. Her dedication to her clients seems almost like a ministry to me. I asked Sally if I could tag along for a work day. Well, thanks for letting me tag along with you today, Miss Sally. You know, I'm very, very curious. How did you even get started doing this nursing care on demand thing?
Well, thanks, Jackie, for riding with me. I have been a nurse many years, and I started in the hospital. I worked in a rehab unit with persons who had all kinds of physical and mental disabilities and needed to be taught how to self-care and how I prepared them to go home and see if they could live at home. And this was well before home care, which is what we're talking about today. In 1978, I began the journey in home health care because I absolutely believe that's where people should be, at home, if at all possible. Clearly, there are times when they need to be in an acute care setting or maybe a long-term care setting, but mostly they need to be in their home where it's comfortable to them, it's safe, it's just a wonderful spot. And if there's a way to take care of them, offer them services of whatever they need for their care, whether it's a wound care or medications or cardiac care, IV therapy, any of the types of services, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy if they've had a stroke and they need that type of service. It's a wonderful place for people to feel safe and to recover to the best degree they can.
Have you ever worked conventionally in a regular hospital, you know, as a floor nurse or a ward nurse?
Yes, I did. I worked at the Fairview Hospital system for 17 years, and I worked in rehab. I worked in nursing supervision. I worked on a medical surgical unit. I worked in education, so I had a broad range of experiences. And I started and developed their home health and hospice programs at Fairview. So that was a wonderful opportunity that I had to further develop my skills in home health care services.
So are your patients mostly adult? Have you had a chance to work with pediatric patients?
I have intermittently worked with pediatric patients. However, at this point, most 99% of our clients are adults. And there are in the metro area home health agencies who work specifically with pediatric clients, because there are special needs and special training to care for pediatric people.
Uh-huh.
They're not just little adults in their physical and emotional needs. So most home health agencies, like the one I'm working with, work predominantly with adults.
So do you consider yourself a freelance nurse?
I work for a home health agency as a visit nurse and follow all of the Medicare regulatory compliance requirements and provide services. I am directed to what kind of clients I should visit, where they live, and so on. But then I make the plan and develop the plan of care and follow the physician orders. You have to have a physician refer you to all of the home health care. So there, it's really, it's a very complex and very legally correct business. Insurance companies, Medicare, medical assistants, all of the organizations that pay for the service are part of what we need to understand and follow through with. So it's very interesting, complicated, fun, challenging. Sometimes you struggle with it, but it's just part of the nursing care that you want to provide. I've been a nurse many, many years, and I like being a nurse. I'm happy with it. I'm comfortable with it.
I ride with Sally to her next client of the day.
Good morning.
Hello.
How are you,
Sally?
Feeling today?
Pretty good.
Pretty good. No aches or pains, huh?
No.
And your catheter's okay?
Yes.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Good to see you. I'll see you later.
See you later.
I say it's a ministry. She says it's just competent nursing care. But for Sally and the many nurses like her in the Twin Cities, it's one and the same. For KFAI Radio, I'm Jackie Maddox.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Susu Jeffrey is a longtime advocate and protector of Coldwater Spring, which is located in Minnehaha Park and is the last natural water table in Hennepin County. Susu is also the creator of Friends of Coldwater and has written multiple articles on the history of the spring and the surrounding landscape. She spoke with KFAI's Armee Rivard about this lesser-known piece of Minneapolis history.
I'm a Susu Jeffrey, also known as Good Water Woman, an advocate for Coldwater Springs, Minnewasne, Water, Spring, Cold. Minnewasne, Coldwater Springs, is a place people come to bless. And of course, when you bless something, it's like a wheel. It goes out, it comes around, you get blessed. You throw out the blessing, it comes back and fills you up. Being at Coldwater is being at a sacred place. Oh, it gives me goosebumps just to say that. Water is so subtle. I mean, you don't see it carving down mountains. And then it flows down, and it flows into the Mississippi, and it flows down to the Gulf of Mexico, and it flows into the Atlantic Ocean, and it mixes with the Pacific Ocean, and it's all one thing, water. Water is what life is about. Cold water is so old, it was flowing before there were even people in this area. I mean, we have a 9,000-year-old bison spear point, and that's the oldest human artifact we have from this area. But cold water had been flowing for thousands of years. So cold water, Minnewasne, is our landscape ancestor. The Dakota people consider the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers their emergence place, the bedote, the meeting of waters. It was their Garden of Eden. It was their place of Genesis. And we have been instructed by Dakota elders to return and return to remember the spirits that feed this sacred place. I first saw Coldwater in 1993 when I was driving around and we were having the huge encampment and problems with the police and trying to stop the expansion of and reroute of Highway 55. And it grabbed me by the heart. It just grabbed me, and it has never let me go. In the early 1960s, MnDOT planned an 8-lane freeway in the Highway 55 Hiawatha corridor, and they began to condemn all the houses. But the citizen resistance paralleled the pressure of the state to do this freeway expansion. People fought. And so it's not a surprise that when it came time to put the road basically into Minnehaha Park, that the citizens continued to press against the power and destruction of the state. We went to meetings for, it must have been 5 years, meeting after meeting after meeting. Finally, they reduced it from an 8-lane freeway to a 4-lane highway. But they rammed it right through parkland. So then they came up with, not only are we going to have a highway, we're going to have an LRT, a light rail transit. And originally they were going to have the light rail transit in the Highway 35 corridor, but they changed their mind. They wanted to go through virgin land. We wanted saving the water and the trees to be an important part of the future. Finally, the Sierra Club blessed them. They stepped in and they said, no, you know, save Minnehaha Park, save the trees, stop the reroute. Things got more and more intense, more meetings. And finally, we moved from meetings to let's go to court. And luckily, the Mendota Dakota people came in the mid to late 90s. And when the Indian people came in, they brought along other tribes. They brought along the Anishinaabe with the sacred Medewawin Society, Ho-Chunk people, Iowa people, and there were some really smart Native leaders who knew how to play the system. And we talked about cultural property, burial site investigations, violation of state and federal environmental laws. So we had to bring in testimony from all over the place. We had architectural digs. We had archaeologists. We had 2 days of testimony by Native Americans from various tribes, and they forced the government to follow its own rules. And it took thousands of hours, hundreds of meetings, and hundreds of people. And we saved it. I mean, it was amazing. And we found out that, yes, the four trees were sacred. Yes, they were old enough. Yes, the water had been flowing for thousands of years. And yes, we were right. And yes, it's important. Saving sacred history. And that's Coldwater. And that's the lesson. And you get blessed. And you bless it. And it's a miracle.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE. Are you a fan of classical music? Have you ever wondered what the piano that Brahms played on sounds like? or what goes on inside the private life of a famous composer from over 200 years ago. You might want to check out the Schubert Club Museum in St. Paul, where historical instruments and composers' private letters coexist with a raft of musical instruments that you can play yourself. KFAI producer and musician Allison Young takes us there in this story.
As I approach the glass doors that lead into the Schubert Club Music Museum on the second floor of St. Paul's Landmark Center, the first thing I notice is a sculpture. It's 20 feet tall and in the shape of a tornado. Affixed to it from top to bottom are musical instruments from all around the world. Sure, there's a flute and a banjo, a euphonium, a xylophone, but there are a few instruments I don't recognize. Like this one that looks like a giant guitar. I've never seen it before. But for some, this instrument is instantly recognizable.
What I find so fun these days, there may be a student that's off to the side and is from a different culture. And they're not sure about this space. They're not sure what they're getting into, but they come in and they notice an instrument that's from their culture. And immediately, a story begins. I had a little boy the other day that said, my grandmother plays the veena. You have a veena. That is so cool. And so it's a great entry point. Anybody who walks in the door relate to what we have.
Kate Cooper is the education and museum director of the Schubert Club. Her goal has always been to make the music museum a welcoming place for visitors, whatever their background. The instrument tornado is in the colorfully painted maker zone, filled with instruments of all types. It's not unusual to see a grand piano next to a theremin, or a set of Indonesian gamelan next to a wall of percussion instruments, or to hear all of them played at once. The museum is just one of many offerings from one of the oldest arts organizations in the United States, the Schubert Club, which presents hundreds of concerts each season, played by top-notch classical musicians. And for many of these concerts, these musicians have the opportunity to play on historical instruments from the museum collection. This gives their performance a more authentic sound and feel from the actual period that the music was composed. And right now, I can see and hear a recording of these historic instruments being played. I just have to press a button in the keyboard journey section of the museum. Kate tells me the collection got started almost by accident. In the early 70s, then artistic and executive director Bruce Carlson acquired one single historical forte piano.
He kept that, and soon another came, and another one, and another one.
He just walked in.
After that, Carlson began actively pursuing the most pristine historical instruments, mostly from the Wurlitzer brokerage. And these include an 1844 piano made by the French builder Erard. Inside is an inscription left by Franz Liszt, confessing to playing a few wrong notes. Another keyboard made by Kisting & Sons sat in a Berlin salon and was likely played by Felix and Fanny Mendelssohn, Robert and Clara Schumann, as well as Brahms. The museum also has a collection of 75 original letters from famous composers, including Beethoven, Verdi, Wagner, even Mozart. They share intimate details of their lives, including their own personal challenges. Sometimes, when we think about the great composers, we forget that they were human beings, too, with worries and concerns just like our own. Kate Cooper draws my attention to one poignant letter that composer and pianist Clara Schumann sent to her father. It underscores their difficult relationship, one that she hoped to heal.
They had a very difficult relationship. It's not necessarily the specific words in the letter, but it's kind of the tone of the letter that you just start to understand all the troubles she went through, and yet she overcame them in such a gracious, forgiving way.
Since the museum is all about inviting us to play the instruments, I head back into the music maker zone to make a little music of my own. Pianos, along with aerophones, which are blown instruments, and chordophones, which are bowed instruments, call to me, as well as a raft of instruments meant to be hit.
When we made the decision to renovate the museum in 2020, it was a wonderful year with the pandemic, but my primary goal was to give visitors an opportunity to finally be able to touch these instruments and play them. And so we added a whole wall of percussion instruments, and again, wanted to represent many different cultures.
Two, three,
so you can get more than one person involved. Even more fun, we have a couple of pre-recorded sound bites of some of those different instruments being played from a rock band or a marching band or an African dance ritual or anything. And they can press the button, listen to those, and then they can grab their instrument and play along. And it's lots of fun.
Too fun.
Looking for something fun as well as mind-expanding to do in downtown St. Paul? Come here as a group of senior citizens or homeschooled kids or just by yourself. Grab sticks from the bucket of beaters and make music. And the best part? It's free. For KFAI, I'm Allison Young. You've been listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Support for Mini Culture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/minneculture.
You have been tuned into Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. If you'd like to hear any of these stories again, you can find them and share them with your pals at Mini Culture's SoundCloud page. Now, coming up next, The Upside Down.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. KFAI is non-commercial, community-powered radio. Support for KFAI comes from KFAI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Programming on KFAI is made possible in part through grants from the state of Minnesota and listeners like you. Thanks for joining me today. You're tuned in to Upside Down. I'm filling in for Chris Berry. My name is Nora, and it's a joy to be with you right now. All right, let's get to it.